particularly great, but it's been a lot worse for Michigan, hasn't it? I mean, this isn't sort of the end of the world, but we'll see what happens as far as people coming in. I want to welcome those of you on our live stream or anybody who may be watching this after the fact. We appreciate you tuning in. If you want to follow along with us, you can go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down and click on the link here for lesson 254 under recent sermons, and then you can click the link and open the notes and follow along if you would like to do that. All right, so what we have this morning is lesson 254, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text. And last week we started looking at Blaney and the 1769 Oxford edition. I do want to make just a quick announcement. So we are officially going to be having this logic class this summer, okay? Nate and I met. We're going to kind of do it together, tag team that. You'll see more about that when it happens, and we're still kind of getting organized. But we did have a meeting to get organized, and what we have decided is that I'm going to finish this class for the season the last Sunday of April, and then in May, the first Sunday in May, we're going to start the class on logic. And we're going to run the class on logic from May, June, July, August, and maybe one Sunday in September. So it's going to be about a 15 to 18 week thing. I've got to figure out a way to wrap this up by the end of April, okay? So that's just a little bit of some housekeeping stuff as far as what to expect moving forward. But we are going to be having that class. All right, so lesson 254, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, Blaney and the 1769 Oxford Text. Introduction. In lesson 253, we began looking at the editorial work that Benjamin Blaney did for Oxford University Press in preparing the 1769 edition. In summary, we observed the following points. Okay, so these are what we covered in the last lesson. Number one, Blaney built upon the work of F.S. Paris, spending 3 to 4 years on his revision. Two, the 1769 Oxford edition became the standard text for future King James Bibles. Three, Blaney made changes to chapter headings, cross-references, marginal notes, and chronology. Four, the most significant changes were to spelling and grammar, which we're going to start talking about today, though these were not explicitly mentioned in Blaney's report. So remember that Blaney published that report in the November 1769 Gentleman's Magazine, where he listed out, you know, what he had done to the text, how long it took him, the process they went through, etc. What he doesn't talk about in that report, in my mind, are the most important issues, and that's what he actually did to the text. What he talked about in that report was a lot of the ancillary stuff, the chapter headings, the cross-references, the marginal notes, the chronology, that kind of stuff is what he mainly addressed in that report in the Gentleman's Magazine from November 1769. And then last review, a copy of Blaney's edition annotated by Gilbert Buchanan. That's the way we decided, right? Buchanan. I lost my spot with my eyes. Let me start over. A copy of Blaney's edition annotated by Gilbert Buchanan shows thousands of changes from the 1611 version. So remember, that was a copy of the Bible that was bought by this gentleman, Buchanan, and he went through and meticulously noted differences between his copy of the 1769 text with the 1611 text. And so we discussed those in review from last time. So in this lesson, we will begin looking at the types of changes that Blaney made to the text. In so doing, we will consider the following categories of revision. So what we're going to look at in this lesson is, first, we're going to look at changes to the number of a noun. Second, changes in verb tense and usage. Third, restoration of 1611 readings. And four, correction of printer's errors. All right, so we're going to try to hit all those, given enough time. That's what we're endeavoring to do. Now, before we start that, I have a note here at the bottom of page one that's kind of important for me to go over with you, okay? So please note, for all the examples listed below, we checked the readings in all of the following editions. So for every example that I have in this lesson, I looked at the example in all of the following editions, okay? So I started with a 1611, I looked at a 1629 Cambridge Folio, I looked at a 1638 Cambridge Folio, the 1683 Cambridge Quarto, the 1762 Cambridge Folio, and then on the top of page 2, the 1769 Cambridge Folio. So obviously, guys, I do not have time to check it in every single edition. So I checked it in what are the sort of the main ones, knowing that There could be an outlier out there that is not known to me at this time. Okay, so look at first dark point on page 2. To save time and space, I have not provided photographic evidence for every example for all of the additions listed above, but only what is necessary to explain each example. So for example, if we're talking about a change and you go from 1611 and then there's no change in that until 1769, I didn't give you all of the intermittent screenshots because you don't need them, okay? So I only provided what I thought was necessary to explain each example. That said, every addition listed was checked for each example. So even though I don't give you a screenshot for every single addition in that list, I looked at every single addition in that list for every example that is in the lesson. But I only took screenshots and included them for where I thought they were necessary for explaining each example. Does everybody understand what I'm saying there? Any questions? Okay, if there are no questions, let's look at our first category of changes with Blaney, all right? Gordon Campbell begins his coverage of Blaney's editorial work by discussing changes in the number of a noun. He says about this quote, this is page 138, "The changes that Blaney wrought are for the most part an implementation of Paris's principles." So stop there. Remember we saw that last time, that Blaney sort of picks the ball up and moves forward with it where Paris left off, all right? "So the changes that Blaney wrought are for the most part an implementation of Paris's principles. On the number of nouns, for example, the names of other gods, Exodus 23:13, became the name of other gods, and keep me from the snare, Psalm 141:9, became keep me from the snares." Okay? So you got a difference there of the names of other gods versus the name of other gods, and keep me from the snare versus keep me from the snares. Okay? So you're talking here about changes to the number of a noun. Alright? So, page 105 of A Textual History of the King James Bible, on page 105 of A Textual History of the King James Bible, Dr. David Norton includes the following additional examples to changes to the number of a noun in footnote 9. He says here in the footnote, he lists Exodus 23:13, Leviticus 25:31, Numbers 1:2, and also verse 18 and verse 20. He mentions Numbers 4:40, Psalm 141:9, which is one that two of those are ones obviously that Campbell mentioned, Isaiah 10:34, and then he mentions two from the Apocrypha, 1 Esdras 2:8 and 1 Maccabees 8:26. So those are examples of changes in the number of a noun. All right. So let's look at these. So if you look at the photos, I'm on the bottom of page 2 for those of you that are following along. Here's the example from Exodus 23:13. Okay? Notice, now there might be other changes here to this verse between 1611 and 1769. We're not worrying about those. We're looking at the ones that we know were made by Blaney here. So I'm aware of the fact that there are other differences, but we're not tracking every difference. We're only trying to keep track of what Blaney did. Does that make sense? Okay, so Exodus 23:13, notice right here, okay, "And make no mention of the names of other gods." Names has an S on it, okay? Then there's no change in that, in all the additions I checked in the list, okay, until you get to Blaney's work in 1769, "And make no mention of the name of other gods." So the change here is from names to what? Name.
Why do you think he did that? I mean, God was plural, so a name refers to God that should be plural too, you would think. Plural.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't... You probably would have to go poking around in the Hebrew. We could maybe check that, or at least try...
Maybe they didn't use the word God. Because that would make it more sounding more right too. God.
Yeah.
But the word "the" is there, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. Let's just see what we can... Alright, so here's the verse. I'm going to turn the tools on in Blue Letter Bible. And... So here's the part in question, Mike. Right? Right here. Of the name. Right? So if we turn this on, if you look at the parsing, notice the number is singular. So my guess is that Blaney saw that that's singular, okay, in the Hebrew. So what he did is he changed plural names to names of, to name of, to more accurately match the fact that the Hebrew here is what? Singular. Okay, that would be my guess as to why he would make a change like that. Okay, now, substantively, I don't think it matters, because you have more than, you have other gods, plural, and obviously, maybe there's different names, obviously, for all these gods, so I think it's, in his mind, Blaine's mind, it would seem to me to be a matter of accuracy to make that editorial change. Okay? Any other questions? So, let's go to the second one, Leviticus 25:13. This one's on the top of page 3. Okay? It's kind of the same concept. Look at Leviticus 25:31. Look at 25:31. But the houses of the villages which have no walls round about them. Walls is what?
Plural.
Plural, okay? Then Blaney makes a change in 1769. But the houses of the villages which have no wall round about them shall be... So the change is from walls to what? Wall. So it's again a change in the number of the noun. Now, do you want to check that one too? Or are we?
We're
here. We might as well.
Most places that are walls don't have multiple walls. I mean, it would make it more secure. But if you got all the houses, the village, you got over one wall, and you got to over another wall.
Leviticus, what is it? 25.
Small village. They'd have walls to separate their animals, so they wouldn't be, going into everybody else's fields. Hard to say.
All right, have no wall. Here's the issue. We're going to click the parsing, and again, you'll see the number is what?
Singular.
Okay, so when Blaney changes it from walls to what?
Wall.
It seems to be a change to bring it more in coherence with the Hebrew in this case. Okay? And again, I don't think it substantively changes anything. I don't think it makes a hill of beans difference as far as understanding goes. All right, Numbers 1:2, okay. Numbers 1:2, okay. So this is talking about taking like a census and numbering the congregation of the children of Israel. And then it says here at the bottom of Numbers 1:2, it says every man by their what? Pole, singular. That's the word pole. Not spelled the way we would spell it now, but it's the word pull. Okay, go to top of page 4. And here we have, okay, every man by their what? Poles. Okay, so I have a little note here. The same observation would apply to Numbers 1:18 and Numbers 1:20. So in other words, in those other two verses, the same change was made. It was originally pole, and then it was changed to what? Poles. The same thing happens in the same chapter. So remember, this is chapter 1, verse what? 2? Right?
Yeah.
So in the same chapter, Numbers chapter 1, it's changed in verse 2, and then it's changed again in verse 18 and in verse 20. It's the same change. Pole singular to poles what?
Mm-hmm.
Plural. Okay? Any questions?
What is poles refer to? Is that name?
So you'd have to read the whole context here, but this is the book of Numbers, and so what God's trying to do is to number the children of Israel, okay? And I don't have my Bible open.
So a pole would be like Benjamin?
A pole would be like I think there's like a standard of where the different tribes were supposed to report to be counted.
It would be like a tribe?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
But if you look at it, just grab Numbers chapter 1. We even today we go to a polling place when we vote, right?
But I don't think that's
not exactly what the meaning is here. But look at Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tabernacle of the congregation on the first day of the second month in the second year after they were come out of the land of Egypt. Take ye a sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel, after their families, by their houses of their fathers, with the number of their names, every man by their poles. So I'm thinking that that's somehow a mechanism that is used to conduct the census and count the number of the children of Israel, where they probably had a specific spot to report for being counted. That's the way I would interpret that. Okay. All right, next one. Numbers chapter 4, verse 30. Okay. Numbers chapter 4, verse 30. So look at the 16:11. It says, by the houses, plural, of their fathers. So again, I'm in Numbers chapter 4, verse 30. And then look at 17:69. By the house of their fathers. So it was plural. Now it's what? Singular. Now notice the wrinkle here, okay? This time we again have the 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition that has made this change before who? Before Blaney did. So here's the 1683 Cambridge Quarto, by the house of their fathers. So that change was actually done in 1683. We now know that the editor of the 1683 was a guy named Scattergood. And if you are interested in that, Alex and I released a video Thursday of this week that went through all of this. But here's the thing. So do we see here again an example of a change to the text that wasn't supposed to be there until much later than what is recorded, than what we can actually find it? So look at the point underneath there on the top of page 5. Here is yet another example of where Campbell and Norton erred by not checking the lesser edition. Yeah. Do I have it numbered wrong? You're right. So, Mike, we need to change that. Okay, good catch. So, sorry for that mistake. Does everybody understand that the change that Norton and Campbell are that Norton and Campbell are ascribing to Blaney in 1769? Do we have evidence of that change happening in 1683? So once again, we have the 1683 Cambridge Quarto making a change that's not supposed to be made until much later. So look at the note on the top of page 5. Yet here is an example of where Norton and Campbell erred not checking the lesser editions. I should say editions, Mike, at the end of that first sentence on page 5. The 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition, H780, records the change from houses to house 86 years before Blaney. Okay? Then we have Psalm 114:9, okay? 1611, keep me from the snare, singular. 1769, keep me from the snares, what? Plural. Okay?
Why do they use the after house? That's what I don't understand.
It's the way
they don't even sound right.
Why do they use
the... It's called... It's called orthography. It's just the way they wrote them. It changes over time. Isaiah 10:34. Notice 16:11, and he shall cut down. What's that word? Huh?
The thickets.
He shall cut down the thickets of the forests, plural, in the 16:11. 1769, Oxford, and he shall cut down the thickets of the forest, singular. Okay. So this first category is all dealing with changes in the number of a noun. So we've seen it go both ways, where a plural is changed to a singular, or a singular is changed to a what? A plural. Okay? Look at the bottom of page 5. I elected not to include the two apocryphal examples cited by Norton in these notes. Interested parties are encouraged to look at 1 Ezra 2:8 and 1 Maccabees 8:26 on their own. I do give you the change, though. I didn't take pictures and put them in the slideshow. So here's 1 Ezra 2:8. Tribes of Benjamin in the 1611 was changed to tribes singular of Benjamin in 1769 in 1 Ezra 2:8. And then 1 Maccabees 8:26, shall keep their covenant in the 1611 became keep their covenants, plural, in 1769. So I didn't give you screenshots of the apocryphal changes just because they're in the Apocrypha and I'm not really too concerned about it, because I don't believe the Apocrypha is scripture, okay? Despite the claims some are making on the internet these days. So, changes, the second category that I want to look at is changes in verb tense and usage. Okay? Changes in verb tense and usage. Regarding this category of change, Professor Campbell writes on page 138, he says, quote, Blaney sometimes prefers grammatical coherence to fidelity to the original. So, he calleth present tense unto him and the 12 and began, Mark 6:7, becomes he called past tense unto the 12 and began. So calleth to what? Called is the change here, alright? Similarly, and said, where have ye laid him? They say unto him, John 11:34 becomes, and said, where have ye laid him? They said unto him. So, say versus what?
Said.
So let's look at these, Mark 6:7, okay? So here it is, and he calleth unto him. 1769, and he called unto him. So is there a change in the tense here?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay? It's a change in the tent, verb tense. Let's look at the next one. John 11:34. Okay? And said, where have ye laid him? They say unto him. 1611 says what?
Say.
1769, and said, where have ye laid him? They said unto him. So say is changed to what?
Said.
Now let me ask you a question. Is say spelled right? Forget your hang up with the F, okay? Say spelled right.
S-A-Y.
S-A-Y. Right? Is this a word change?
Yes.
It's a word change. Does it alter the substance of the verse? It does not. It's a change in a verb tense. The verb is the same, it's just the difference between present versus what?
Past.
Okay? What was that change made?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Go to John. Oh, did I miss something here? Okay. On pages 110 and 111 of his textual history, Dr. Norton discusses some additional examples of Blaney making changes in verb tense and usage in the apocryphal section of the 1769. So again, I didn't give you screenshots of this, but we're going to quote what Norton said about it. Okay? He says first on page 110, Blaney changes four of the apocrypha's five uses, of the modern third person singular he sticks, and the like, to the old-fashioned form used everywhere else, he sticketh. Sticketh. Right? There you go. Don't sticketh, okay? And then, so he says that in the text, and then you'll notice right here the little 18, the superscript 18, that's prompting you to go to footnote 18, which I also quoted here, so this is the footnote from the text. And he's got marked 1 Esdras 4:21, Ecclesiasticus 44:12, Baruch 6:9 and 21. And then Norton notes that he missed Ecclesiastes 22:2. Consequently, every man that takes remains as the one modern third person singular in the current text of the King James. And he's obviously referring there to the apocryphal section. Okay. A couple of additional examples are given on page 111. Blaney makes two changes in verb tense that are less justifiable. At Leviticus 13:29, he takes a man or woman as a plural subject and so alters have to have, and he treats people similarly in 2 Esdras 3:35. So let's look at that first, okay? Notice, for what people have so kept the commandments in the 1611 was changed to, or what people have so kept the commandments in 1769. So again, that's 2 Esdras. I'm not giving you screenshots of that. I did include it just for, trivia's sake. But let's look at the other canonical example here, okay? Notice, if a man or woman hath a plague, okay? That's what the 1611 has. Top page 8. Notice the 1762 Cambridge still had that. If a man or woman hath a plague, so Paris kept what word in there? Hath. And then look at 1769. If a man or a woman, what? Have a plague. So again, change in tense. Okay? Go to... Yeah, I don't really know if there's a change in tense there, is there?
Have and have sounds like
it. To me, it sounds like it's different. It's a different
thing. Yeah.
It's present.
One has the plague and one doesn't. Right?
When do you get plague on a beard?
No,
if I'm wondering if it was referring to a woman or a man. Maybe it was something hair condition.
It says, if a man or woman hath a plague upon the head or the beard.
Because usually something to do with the skin, but your hair.
You know, those all those hair plagues running around.
Or maybe it's those chin hairs on the older women.
Oh, come on, Mark. So, again, to me, absolutely no difference in meaning half versus have. Same thing. Six of one, half a dozen of another. But is it a change?
Yeah. It is. In today's language, we would say has. And it all means the same thing.
Right. We would say if a man or woman has a plague.
Yeah.
If a man or woman have a plague, if a man or woman hath a plague.
Yeah.
No difference. No. The dude or woman, the they have a plague. And so they need to, you know, take evasive action according to the law is the idea. Alright? Mm-hmm. Alright, third category for this lesson is the restoration of 1611 readings. Regarding this category, Professor Campbell wrote the following in Bible, the story of the King James Version 1611 to 2011. He, Blaney, occasionally restores 1611 readings. Okay? Now, this one, watch. Fleshy tables of the heart, 2 Corinthians 3:3, had since 1617 been misprinted as fleshly tables of the heart, but Blaney restored fleshy. Okay? So we'll look at that example here in a minute. Dr. Norton also comments on this category of change made by Blaney. In footnote 15 on page 109 of a textual history, Professor Norton provides two additional examples to the one cited by Campbell, 2 Corinthians 8:7 and 1 Timothy 4:16. Regarding these examples, he states the following in the text. Finally, it is worth noting that Blaney restores three 1611 readings. Now, Mike,
make a note.
See how I have the footnote 15 here?
Yeah.
I need to add a footnote 15 to the beginning of this line. Okay. So he's talking about this on page 109. He says this in the text. Finally, it's worth noting that Blaney restores 3 1611 readings. And then in the footnote, he gives you what they are. 2 Corinthians 3:3, but 1617's fleshly is still found in some editions. So we'll look at that one in a minute. 2 Corinthians 8:7 and 1 Timothy 4:16. So everybody go quickly to 1 Corinthians 3:3. 2 Corinthians. Thank you, Amy. The numbers. I seriously think sometimes I'm a little dyslexic with numbers. I'm not joking. I kind of do think that sometimes. Okay, so just have that open. We'll look at that in a second, all right? So everybody look at the bottom of page 8. So this example, 2 Corinthians 3:3, spills over into two pages because the first part of the verse is at the bottom of the page, so you have to go to the top part of the next page to get the rest of the verse. But here's what we're talking about. Notice, but in fleshy tables of what? The heart. Okay? Now I gave you all of these. For this one, 1629 Cambridge Folio, it still says what? It says fleshly. Okay? So here it said fleshy. Now it says what? Fleshly. Both Campbell and Norton say that became a misprint in 1617 that just got passed along and passed along and nobody caught it, is what they seem to be suggesting. Okay, here's 1638 Cambridge Folio, again it's flesh li. 1683 Cambridge Quarto, flesh li. 1762 Cambridge Folio, this would have been Paris's work, flesh li. And then you get to the 1769 Oxford text and it says what? Fleshy. So fleshy is what we had if we go all the way back up to the beginning and we look where? At the 1611. So what Blaney does in this case is he restores a reading that was the original reading when? In 1611, before it got arguably misprinted, and then he corrects it. Okay? So everybody look at your Bible. 2 Corinthians 3:3. Mine says fleshy.
Mine? Yeah.
Does anyone say fleshly at the end of 2 Corinthians 3:3? What do you have?
Fleshy.
What do you have, Bart?
I didn't look, but I don't understand what fleshy even means.
The heart is fleshy.
It's your physical self.
Compared to a tablet, they're comparing it to a tablet which is stone.
Yeah.
And the heart is fleshy compared to that.
So the difference is, in the context, is writing it on stone versus writing it in the heart.
Okay.
That's only
two different. So what? Fleshly and fleshy.
I don't think so. I think one is clearly a printer error. They accidentally spelled it what? Fleshly. And nobody, it's close enough and nobody caught it until Blaney changed it.
They made the mistake and then the next time they go, oh, that's okay.
Does anyone have one that says fleshly?
No.
Okay. Because there are some that I think still say that. Let's look at the next one. 2 Corinthians 8:7. Alright? Now notice. Therefore, as ye abound in everything in faith and utterance. Okay? So notice, so we're at 2 Corinthians 8:7 now. Notice that the 1611 said, and utterance. Let me get caught up here. Hang on. Okay? But then look at 1629 Cambridge. It says, in faith, in what? So, and is changed to what? In. 1638 Cambridge, it's in utterance. It's still in utterance. 1683 Cambridge, in utterance. 1762 Cambridge Folio, in utterance. Now it's in italics. It wasn't before. And then here we have the Blaney text of 1769. It's now back to what?
Yeah.
And utterance. And utterance was the original reading of the 1611 back here. So these are restoration, this category of change are restorations of 1611 readings. Okay? The next one is 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 16. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 16. Notice it says, take heed unto thyself and unto the doctrine. 1611 says the doctrine. Alright? Verse 1629 Cambridge, take heed unto thyself and unto thy doctrine. So the doctrine became what? Thy doctrine. 1638 Cambridge Folio, take heed unto thyself and unto thy doctrine. 1683 Cambridge Quarto, take heed unto thyself and unto thy doctrine. 1762 Cambridge Folio, take heed unto thyself and unto thy doctrine. And then 1769 Cambridge Folio, take heed unto thyself and unto the what? The doctrine. So again, 1769 reading reinstates the reading that was where? In the 1611. Okay? Now, before we go any further, look at the next category. Does anybody have any questions or comments? I know there's an element to this that sounds a bit like a broken record, but is it beyond historical doubt that when we read a standard Bible today, that we are not reading only the choices of the translators. Okay? There's obviously changes that have happened here to this text as you work your way through time. Okay? Alright, so, bottom of page 12, correction of printer's errors. Campbell also comments on the correction of a printer's error by Blaney. He says on page 140, one particularly insightful correction of an error that is almost certainly the fault of the printer rather than the translators is the shift of a comma. For in this we groan earnestly, notice the commas after earnestly, desiring, 1611, is corrected to, for in this we groan, comma, earnestly. So the comma was originally after earnestly, he switches it to before an additional one from the Apocrypha. Top page 13 in your notes. He spots two genuine errors that arguably go back to the compositor rather than the translator. So remember, the compositor was the guy who was setting the type. So what these two guys are saying, what about this example, what Norton and Campbell are saying is that the compositor put the comma in the wrong spot. That's what they're saying. Okay? He spot two genuine errors that arguably go back to the original compositor rather than the translators. First Maccabees 16:14 is corrected with threescore and seventieth to threescore and 17th. Now I might have 17th, yes. I gotta check that one, Mike. I'm not sure if I typed that right, so let's check it. 2 Corinthians 5:2 is corrected from we groan earnestly, comma, desiring to we groan, comma, earnestly desiring. That's the one that we already mentioned. So it's interesting to consider that by 1769, there were only two examples of Blaney's work that Campbell and Norton considered to be print errors that survived from the original printing in 1611. So in their estimation, now, obviously they're making some judgment calls here, but in their estimation, as they evaluate the work, there's only two things that they're willing to say are legitimate what? Printer's errors that had survived all the way from 1611 all the way through to 1769, all right? So let's look at the 2 Corinthians 5:2 example, all right? So here is 1611. For in this we groan, earnestly, comma, desiring. So 1611 has a comma after what word? Earnestly, all right? Notice 1629 Cambridge Folio, the comma is after what word?
Earnestly.
1638 Cambridge Folio, the comma is after earnestly again. 1683 Cambridge Quarto, the comma is after earnestly. 1762 Cambridge Folio, the comma is after earnestly. And then we come down here, 1769 Oxford Folio, the comma is moved to after what?
Groan.
Which
I think is correct.
Which I think is correct as well.
Yeah. I don't think you groan earnestly.
For in this we groan, earnestly desiring. It makes the sentence reads better with the comma where?
There.
There than there.
Yeah.
Okay?
Earnestly as opposed to sarcastic.
So if you look at the bottom of page 14, so in the next lesson we'll continue our look at the editorial work of Benjamin Blaney. So here was my problem with this lesson. It was 14 pages long. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get through these 14 pages. Okay, so we are admittedly done considerably earlier than we normally are. So if anybody has any pertinent comments or questions, let me know.
All of the what do you call like periods and commas?
Punctuation.
There was no punctuation from the original Greek or Hebrew.
The Greek and Hebrew did not have punctuation.
So whenever, but like the earlier Tyndale and when did they start using the punctuation?
Well, I mean, they start. I think Tyndale had punctuation. I'd have to check. I have a Tyndale Bible at home. I'd have to look. But for sure by the Geneva Bible, they're using punctuation. And punctuation is part of English. So Greek and Hebrew didn't have it, but you need punctuation in English to, you know, help you understand what's going on.
And then like spelling, that punctuation changed over time.
Punctuation. Listen, punctuation, I swear to you, you get 10 English class, English teachers, and ask them what appropriate punctuation is, and you're going to get, you know, a ton of different answers because nobody can agree on it, even in modern, you know.
Some are old school.
What's that?
Some are still old school.
Some are old schools, you know, so I've seen it where you can on a Chromebook or on a if you're in Google Chrome as your web browser, you can install a tool called Grammarly. And what Grammarly will do is it will assist you as you're typing with fixing grammar. Okay? So I have used, I'm not even joking, there's been times where I have taken something that I wrote and I've submitted it to an AI and it said, fix the grammar without changing any words. And it spits something out. Then I copy paste that into somewhere else, and then Grammarly wants to change three more things from what the AI said as far as proper punctuation and grammar. Okay, so like it's even today people can't agree on certain aspects of punctuation. So it is true that a lot of the changes are simply punctuation, updating, and spelling. No one's disputing that. But the fact is there are other changes that are not updates in spelling and changes in punctuation. They're word changes. We've seen all sorts of things as we've gone through this over the last number of weeks. Okay?
What were the years of Shakespeare?
Shakespeare is writing his plays in the late 1500s into the early 1600s.
Wasn't he a punctuated person?
What do you mean punctuated?
Well, I mean, did he punctuate stuff? Because he was
I'm sure he did. You'd have to look at the original text of his plays, but I'm sure he did.
You'd think they would have been doing it back then in the 1500s.
Well, there's punctuation in the 1560 Geneva Bible, for sure.
So, it was just after the Hebrew and Greek.
There is no punctuation in the Hebrew and Greek.
And
you need punctuation
in
English.
What year did that end?
Huh?
What year did that end?
Whenever the New Testament, Old Testament documents were finished, and then they were copied without punctuation. So when you translate into English, English has punctuation as part of the language. So you need to punctuate stuff so that the English reader can make sense of what they're reading. The problem is that standard of punctuation and orthography is the fancy word for spelling, how you're going to write a word. Okay, are you going to have the F or are you going to have an S? That's orthography. Okay? Now, one thing I want to mention, since we're done early, does anyone else have any questions?
So was that in the Greek and the Hebrew with no, I mean, like, how did they know where a sentence stopped and began? Or, I mean, or was it just on and on and on and on? And then, like, when they started to translate that, like Tyndale or one of the early writers, they had to figure out where a sentence ended and then another one began.
Well, there's this leads to all sorts of disputes about stuff like verse numbering and chapter breaks.
Yeah.
Okay? Because there was no verse numbering in, when Paul wrote Romans, there was no numbered verses. The way we read it, you remember a few years back when I was talking about reading out of a paragraph Bible that didn't have all the stuff in it? The way I don't know if any of you ever took me up on trying that for a while. Did you like it? It's different because you're reading it more like the way that the Romans would have received the letter. When you have, I have a Schofield Bible here, there's all sorts of metatextual stuff in a Schofield Bible that breaks the text up into smaller chunks. I like reading the Bible often without all of that stuff because you just can sort of absorb the information, number one, without distractions, and number two, just sort of as it would have been read by the person that or people that received it. They were letters, right? And so, like, I'm looking at 2 Corinthians here in my Bible, it's got all this stuff in it, and it's good for preaching and Bible study to be able to direct everybody to where you're teaching from and stuff like that, but it's also good to read it sometimes without all that scaffolding in there. Okay? So on Thursday of this week, I'm going to throw this in here since we have a little bit of time and encourage everybody to watch this. Alex Boyko and I, Alex is a 21-year-old college student at University of South Florida. I met him at the Bible conference in Chicago last winter, and he's a history major. And he is the gentleman who's been assisting me in helping to collect all these different editions of the King James Bible. Okay? Well, you guys know that around lesson 250, my other friend Christopher Yetzer, the missionary in Italy, he sent me some stuff about how a bunch of the changes that had been attributed to F.S. Paris in 1743 and 1762 had actually been done much earlier by this 1683 Cambridge Quarto, right? And so I've been including that ever since then in the discussion where it's pertinent and where it's relevant. Well, what Alex did is he went and tried to track down who the editor of that 1683 Cambridge Quarto is, and we believe that we have found out, and it's due to his work on this, and we believe it's a guy named Anthony Scattergood. Okay? So Alex and I recorded a video where we were talking about this. So this document here is Alex's work. This is on the church website. Let me just show you where this is. I can get back here quick enough. If you go to the GraceLifeBibleChurch.com website, you're going to want to go to February 13, and it says Research Breakthrough, Uncovering the Identity of the Editor of the 1683 Cambridge, Uncovering the Identity of the 1683 Cambridge Editor, Chat with Alex Boyko. Okay? So, if you click on that, you can get the video, the audio, and the notes from that conversation. And here are the notes that Alex prepared for our conversation on this particular topic. And I would encourage all of you, if you haven't already watched this, this would be good supplementary. What just happened? This would be good supplementary information for you guys to have, because we believe we have accurately identified who this editor is. Now, there's a lot of stuff in this document. I'm not going to cover all of it, but I do want to just point out a couple things. Okay? Let's see here. So notice this entry right here. Notice it says the name Anthony Scattergood. See this name underlined in red right here?
Yeah.
Anthony Scattergood. We think that he is the editor of this. And we're working on some follow-up videos that are going to cover some more aspects of this. But he looked at, where does he say? He looked at a ton of editions. From London, Oxford, Edinburgh, Amsterdam, and Cambridge for all these verses. And it's just proving more proof of what we've already been discussing here. Okay, and then down here there's some entries. Note this: that his library was bought, and in his library, notice there was a Cambridge 1683 Bible in the library of Anthony Scattergood. Okay, and then here is his name mentioned in the publication of some other things related to language. Dr. Scattergood right here, and he's related to Cambridge University Press, and John Hayes is the printer. So if you didn't watch that video and you're interested in that, I would strongly suggest or recommend that you go back and check that out. Alex and I are going to have another video coming up here in the near future, not quite sure exactly when, where we're going to take one of these examples from his list, and we're going to break down that example and discuss why that's important. And it's related to our greater conversation about the changes that have been made and when they've been made and how things are very much more uneven than people realize, and sort of what all that means. So So be on the lookout for that, and if you're interested, check the bonus lesson or the conversation that Alex and I had. And if you are only interested in the video, you can go right here. It's on YouTube, and again, it's on YouTube under the title Research Breakthrough. Okay? All right, anybody got any comments or questions? No?
So Alex is saying, maybe you can comment on what are your plans for the direction for the rest of the class so far, or up to what point are we going?
Yeah, good question. So my first order of business is we're going to finish discussing Blaney's work. It's probably going to take a few more lessons, and there's a big topic that we haven't really talked about at all, and that's the issue of the italics, the changes that have been made to the italics. So we're going to finish talking about Blaney, we're going to talk about the italics, we're going to talk about why the Blaney's text basically became the standard text, we'll talk a little bit about the American text, the text in America, and then we'll probably stop. In the summer we're going to do the logic class, and then when we come back next fall, I want to kind of talk through how the text of the Reformation was undermined and the steps that led up to the creation of modern versions. It's kind of what I'm thinking, and then when we get to that point, probably would end the class. Okay? Was there any other housekeeping issues? Okay, well, if there are no issues, we can be done a little bit early. I appreciate your attention. We'll be here next week, and we'll continue to look at some other categories of revision from Benjamin Blaney in 1769. Appreciate your attention.